KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I'm from Milpitas,
Union City.
Mission Bay.
I do not know where I'm from.
Coming up, UC Berkeley's new chancellor wants to make space for all people to be heard.
I believe that any attack on free speech is an attack on the right of free speech for us all.
Then we'll talk with a constitutional lawyer about exactly what speech is protected.
The First Amendment really protects the ideas, even if they're racist, and the speech, even if it's racist.
And a high school reporter explains why Korean pop music is making people in San Francisco want to dance.
You don't need to know the language. The way it feels just makes you feel a certain way.
Catching all kinds of feelings today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Well, today is the first day of classes for students at UC Berkeley. That means it's also the first day of classes for new Chancellor Carol Crist. She's a longtime academic who first came to Berkeley to teach Victorian literature back in 1970. She moved into administration, then left the school to become president of Smith College for a decade. When she returned, she became provost, Berkeley's second highest position of authority. Today, she's the first female chancellor in the school's history. So what's in store for UC Berkeley under Carol Crist? KLW's Sonia Hudson reports, and a note to our listeners, Sonia is currently a student at UC Berkeley.
It's 8 a.m. in Sproul Plaza, the start of a new day for Chancellor Carol Crist. The campus is buzzing with students preparing for the new semester.
This is the most exciting time of the year. You're surrounded by new beginnings. These new students who are beginning their college careers, whether undergraduate or graduate, you have new faculty beginning their careers at Berkeley, as I remember so vividly when I arrived here as an assistant professor of English decades ago. And you just take that kind of sense of hope and buoyancy from the students.
Hope is necessary on this campus. The school is dealing with sexual harassment scandals and major cost of living concerns. Also, Berkeley went from a budget surplus to a huge deficit under former Chancellor Nicholas Dirks. At a press conference last week, Crist says she wants to create a new financial model.
A robust financial model that not only eliminates our deficit, but puts Berkeley on a sustainable footing for the foreseeable future.
Crist released her budget for the upcoming fiscal year earlier this month. She set a goal of cutting the campus's $110 million deficit by nearly half in the next year. Her budget contains new revenue streams, including new or expanded academic programming and private gifts. Last year, the campus brought in more gifts than ever before. But her budget also comes with roughly $20 million in cuts to academic, research, and administrative divisions. The student union is the main campus hub for more than 40,000 students. Most students I speak with don't know much about the deficit, but many do think the previous chancellor seemed disconnected from students.
He would never show up to student events.
That's sophomore Anna Whitney, a member of the Cal Berkeley Democrats.
I mean, he would only ever go to like student government meetings like once a semester, and you would never see him anywhere else on campus, nor would he be responsive to student demands.
Carol Crist wants to do things differently. She publicly greeted students arriving on campus last week. And Whitney says she's already seen the new chancellor be more responsive than Nicholas Dirks.
At least in rhetoric, she seems to be more open to collaborating with students on multiple levels. I have reached out to her on issues of sustainability, and she's been responsive. But the real test will come once the fall semester starts and things really get rolling and she unfolds her agenda with her actions.
One of those actions is making this what she calls a free speech year. UC Berkeley was thrust into the national spotlight in February when a scheduled talk by right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos resulted in a riot just outside the student union. The campus administration was criticized when it canceled that speech and a later talk by conservative author Ann Coulter because of safety concerns. Carol Crist says she wants to stop these violent protests that seek to shut down conservative speaking events.
I believe that any attack on free speech, no matter how abhorrent the views are that are expressed, is an attack on the right of free speech for us all.
Crist is planning several panels with guests who have highly divergent viewpoints. And she's working with campus police to make sure conservative speaking events are safe for everyone.
Immediately, she reached out to our organization, the Berklee College Republicans, and scheduled a meeting about reclaiming UC Berkeley's free speech mantle.
Senior Nawid Thomas is the vice president of the group that organized the canceled Yiannopoulos and Coulter talks.
It is incumbent upon universities to expose students to a breadth of different ideological views, and she seems to take this commitment very seriously at the moment.
Crist also says she's working with the city of Berkeley to reach out to local left-wing groups to encourage them to only protest non-violently. On another front, students have called out for stricter punishment of university faculty who are accused of sexual harassment.
We've had some sexual harassment cases that have been deeply, deeply distressing and concerning to many of us here.
The campus has been criticized for using too light a hand in punishing prominent faculty like then-law school dean Sujeet Chowdhury, who allegedly sexually harassed an employee. Crist says a new policy from the system-wide UC office speeds up the investigation timeline and requires the chancellor to approve any punishments. Also, her administration is trying to foster discussions within the faculty about sexual harassment.
I mean, everyone knows about what's the kind of open secret, you know, the faculty member who harasses students often serially. And what we have to do is change the community tolerance of that behavior or the willingness to stay silent.
Finally, Crist has to deal with complaints from students and parents that there isn't enough affordable housing for students. I'm riding the 51B bus towards campus, and long rides on this line are the reality for many Berkeley students. If you don't start looking for housing early, you could end up really far from campus. That's what happened to senior Abhishek Dhawan.
So, I mean, honestly, with me, I kind of woke up a little late, so that was the main issue, and then everything that was available at that point in time was getting a bit above my budget.
Again, UC Berkeley Chancellor Carol Crist.
We house by far the lowest percentage of our undergraduates of any of the undergraduate campuses in the UC system, only 22%. This is unacceptable. One of my highest priorities is to increase our capacity for student housing, both through building on our own land, but also in partnerships with local developers.
UC Berkeley is already building a new dorm for 775 students that's expected to be completed by next August. But creating more new housing will prove a tough task when the school already faces deficits and cutbacks. Despite Crist's ambitious plan to cut the deficit nearly in half, her staff still predicts a $2 billion funding gap over the next 10 years. As she says, hope abounds on campus at the start of the year. But this scholar-turned-chancellor knows well what Victorian author Charles Dickens wrote. Little do we know what lays afore us. In Berkeley, I'm Sonia Hudson for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The National Park Service today has decided to issue a permit to right-wing group Patriot Prayer for a rally on Saturday in San Francisco's Crissy Field. Organizers call the San Francisco event a free speech rally, touting their right to peacefully rally for free speech. On their Facebook page, Patriot Prayer claims, quote, extremists are not welcome. There's a similar rally being held in Berkeley the following day.
But these rallies come in the aftermath of the deadly Charlottesville, Virginia protests just 10 days ago. San Francisco supervisors, the mayor, and other officials have either expressed outrage or wanted the rally permit to be revoked. Bay Area groups are organizing to counter a rally. But what can happen legally? Where's the line when it comes to rallies that have the potential to turn violent? What does the First Amendment protect and what does it not? I talked with University of San Francisco constitutional law professor Julie Nice for some clarification on free speech.
The general rule, of course, is that speech is protected. That really means generally all speech should be protected, even if it's, shall we say, extremely unpopular speech. And while that's the case that all speech is protected, there are some exceptions to that. The free speech protections do not protect incitement of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So if, let's say, neo-Nazis or the Ku Klux Klan or white supremacists were saying, generally, we are hoping to inspire our listeners to cause harm to racial minorities or any other particular group. Honestly, as long as they're only spouting their ideology of racism, it's protected speech.
Mm-hmm.
The tricky question for all of us is, when does that speech of hate
mm-hmm.
cross the line to incitement of violence?
Right.
And that's really what we're dealing with here.
Mm.
The problem is that there are three requirements that have to be met before the courts will consider it incitement to violence. So the speakers have to intend to incite violence.
Mm-hmm.
The violence has to be imminent in the circumstances. And overall, the court has to view the circumstances as likely to produce such violence. So it's got to be intentional, imminent, and likely. All three of those have to be met. So that creates our problem here. Basically, free speech is protected only up until the point where violence is imminent. But by the time, of course, we get to that point, we're all in a new, you know, very scary territory, and thus our tensions today.
Can you tell me about the case of Brandenburg versus Ohio, and what did that say?
Yeah, Brandenburg versus Ohio is the very famous case that established the test that I'm describing, that while almost all political speech is protected, even if it's hateful, it is not protected when there is an incitement of violence. In the Brandenburg case, there were members of the Ku Klux Klan that announced they were going to hold a Klan rally out in the middle of, I believe, a cornfield somewhere in Ohio. And they invited the media to come and watch them burn a cross and spew their racist ideology in the middle of a cornfield in the middle of rural Ohio. They were prosecuted for what we all know is, you know, meant by a cross burning, which is supposed to instill terror in racial minorities in particular.
Right.
But the court ruled, and the United States Supreme Court ruled in Brandenburg versus Ohio, that there was no imminent violence that was likely in those circumstances. There were no particular victims immediately present. So even if they successfully inspired their audience, the KKK on that day, to become more racist and to be more activist in harming racial minorities, it was at that point simply what we call advocacy of unlawful behavior in the future. And that is still speech and still protected under Supreme Court precedent.
Mm. So people listening to this right now might be kind of shaking their heads and wondering, okay, if it is protected by free speech, what is it considered? What law does it break, I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, certainly when someone trespasses onto property, for example, to burn a cross in an African-American family's yard, for example, or when someone actually threatens physical harm, you know, face to face of another person's body, and that's an assault under criminal law. There are many criminal laws which may apply to the conduct.
Mm.
As soon as you cross the line into conduct, you may be in violation of criminal law. But to stand on a soapbox in the middle of a public square and to spew white supremacist speech alone, just the speech alone, even if the speech is encouraging unlawful harm to others in the future, we protect the speech. Mm. And, you know, again, I can understand that we are really living through a time that's fraught with our feelings about the real fear, or may I say terror, you know, that this kind of speech evokes and causes. So we have to grapple with this. But up till now, this has been how our courts have dealt with it.
Can precedent be used to prevent a rally? Or if somebody says this same group 3 weeks ago held a rally and it went bad, there was a lot of violence, et cetera.
Right.
Can that legally, you know, is that grounds for some kind of prevention of future rallies by that group?
There are cases where the courts have made it fairly clear that the government may not deny permits to speak based on some history of disturbances or violence having erupted at similar rallies in the past. So the government has to take each permit request basically on its own terms, figuring out how to allow the speech, having sufficient law enforcement mechanisms in place. It's the duty of the government and law enforcement to control the crowd and prevent violence. And, you know, of course, that was one of the controversies in Charlottesville, whether there were sufficient protections in place. But that's the duty on the government and the police force. It's really not a duty of the speaker. So the takeaway here is that the First Amendment, as currently interpreted by the Supreme Court and our other federal courts, really protects the ideas, even if they're racist, and the speech, even if it's racist, even if it's advocating the overthrow of the government or harm to particular groups of people in the future. And the line remains that they protect that rally, they protect that speech all the way up until the speakers have somehow demonstrated intent to create imminent violence, and that violence is very likely in the immediate circumstances. Then the police can come in and try to stop the protest.
That's Julie Nice, a constitutional law professor at the University of San Francisco. Find links to her writings at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now we'll go to the next generation. KLW worked with high school interns over this summer. And this week, we're playing the stories they produced. Today's is about Korean pop, or K-pop, a musical genre known for its signature techno beats, synchronized dance moves, and fashionable matching outfits worn by girl and boy bands. If you want to learn to dance to K-pop music, you don't need to go all the way to South Korea. Allison Ajpa Perez is a big K-pop fan. She stopped by City Dance Studio right here in San Francisco to learn the moves to go with her favorite K-pop songs.
4 years ago, I discovered my love for K-pop, or Korean pop music, and this summer, I finally sat in on my first K-pop dance class at City Dance Studio in San Francisco.
Let's go. 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
During the class, Amber Davina, the instructor, stands at the front of the room. He begins counting to prepare the students, and then starts counting again.
5, 6, 7, 8. Sit, knee, knee, and a shoot, and a step. Pull, and right, left.
He bends his knee as though sitting on air. Then he moves his right knee out. Then back in. Then he steps out to the right. He then shoots his hands forward and brings his hands back to the side, where he then steps out to the left.
That's good. Can I try with music?
The 12 students in the studio follow his movement. Everyone speeds up. Boy. Amber Divina has been dancing for over 20 years, but this K-pop class is new. It's only been around for a few years. In an interview with 24 Hour K-pop, a local K-pop television channel, Divina explained that K-pop isn't much different from American hip-hop.
So what is your take on the connection of dance with K-pop?
A lot of Korean artists, I think they look up to American hip-hop music. Mm-hmm. And so when they make their music, they take that inspiration and make it something better. Mm-hmm. And along with the hip-hop music comes with the dance.
So you choreographed that flash mob for B1A4.
Now is a good time to be teaching K-pop dance classes in San Francisco. K-pop is still not mainstream, but it's growing in popularity in the United States. Even if you haven't heard of K-pop, you've probably heard at least one K-pop song. Gangnam Style. That song broke many records. It was the first YouTube video to reach a billion views. But the rising popularity of K-pop music is a part of the spread of all South Korean culture that began in the late 90s with what's known as the Hallyu Wave or the Korean Wave. Like a lot of people, the first time I heard of K-pop was on YouTube. At the time, I was watching an anime cartoon called Attack on Titan. I stopped watching Attack on Titan and clicked on another YouTube video. In this video, there were people dressed up as characters from the anime cartoon. They were dancing to a K-pop song called This Love by Shinhwa. I instantly fell in love with this song because it was different from the music I usually heard, like Taylor Swift and Katy Perry. Not only could they sing, but they could also dance, and their choreography was mesmerizing. All the members' dance moves were in sync. Even though I couldn't understand what they were saying, it didn't matter, because the beat made me want to dance and sing along. Soon, I discovered more K-pop music. In this clip, EXO is dancing powerfully, and the song is called Overdose. When EXO performs, you can see an ocean of light sticks with EXO written on them. Most K-pop groups or solo artists have their own colors and their own design light sticks that their fans can have and wave when they have concerts or performances. All my friends and some of the people who know me know that I like K-pop. Some of them don't like K-pop, but I don't really mind. My younger sister likes K-pop too. Sometimes I hear her sing the English parts of EXO Monster. My youngest sister did not want to sing it on the radio, unfortunately.
Boom, from here, transfer the weight, pulling it to the right, up, boom.
My love for K-pop is why I was really excited to be in Amber Divina's class.
From here, you step back, and then I'm gonna pull my heel in.
During the class, another K-pop fan, Aloisa Herbert, is learning K-pop dance moves for the first time. As she danced, she shot her arms up as if she were about to fight someone and went back into a chill pose.
This type of dance made me feel very, very confident. I mean, even though I kind of struggled at first, but eventually, as soon as I got all the moves down, I became confident.
Herbert says one of the reasons she loves K-pop is because it's such a broad genre. It can be R&B, hip-hop, pop, rock, or electronic. And it usually involves heavily synchronized choreography. Herbert doesn't know Korean, but she says that doesn't matter.
Music is, you know, instruments. The language doesn't matter. You can look up the lyrics if you're really bothered by that. But music is the way it feels just, or sounds just makes you feel a certain way.
I didn't dance this time around. I was too nervous. But I'm thinking I might sign up for a beginner's lesson here at City Dance Studio. Someday, maybe, I'll be able to dance like one of my favorite groups, Twice. For KALW, I'm Allison Achpa Perez. Madeline, bell, bell, bell.
Allison Ajpa Perez was part of KALW's high school internship program this summer. She's a student at Philip and Sala Burton High School in San Francisco. And that's it for Cross Currents today. Our team includes Andy Bosselman, Nina Gensler-Debs, Gabe Graben, Raquel Maria Dillon, Stephen Short, Andrew Selzer, and Laura Wenis. Today's show is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Killer Caribou from Livermore. Killer Caribou is one of many bands playing at the Summer Bummer Fest. That's at 924 Gilman in Berkeley on Sunday. Why the name? Why? Because it's the end of summer. Bummer. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.